welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we also link to our guests on that page, as well as the schedules page prior to their appearance on the program. So we encourage you to go to their website, check them out, see what they have to offer. If it resonates with you, fly with it. I would encourage you to do that. And let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Email address is TMYS. That stands for Tell Me Your Story. TMYS at richarddugan.com. That's TMYS at richarddugan.com. Hope that you will drop us a line and let us know what you think. And then, you know, check out our guests and maybe touch base with them as well. We'll be giving you all that good information as far as our guest is concerned shortly. But first, I want to let you know who our guest is today. Our guest today is... The subject matter is rather unique, at least I think it is, and we are very privileged, I think, to have with us a gentleman who has written, you might say, an unusual book. It's called, and it was right at my, when I first read the title, I'm going, oh, this is great, The Metaphysics, and it's kind of like, I could have stopped there, of ping pong. Really? The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. And then I started thinking about it from that perspective. You could have even said the metaphysics of the tides, or, you know, and so forth and so on. And Guido, I believe it's De Sospiro is my guest. Yeah. Have I got that right?
Correct. Well, actually, the whole last name is Mina De Sospiro.
Mina
words.
De Sospiro.
Yeah.
Guido Di Mina De Sospiro.
That's correct.
I have it right. And that is, am I correct, Italian?
Yes.
Okay. So at least I have the country correct. Guido Mina Di Sospiro is my guest. The book is called The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. Very interesting title. Obviously, from my upbringing, my education, my search throughout my life, it's very appropriate because life is, if I may say, like a ping pong game. back and forth, but the ball always lands on different spots on the table or off the table, or it might hit the net. And, of course, kind of like our lives. It's back and forth sometimes. As much as, you know, we'd like to have things settle down a little bit, not be so, I was going to say chaotic, but there is a rhythm to it. There is a rhyme and a reason and so forth. First of all, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also wanting to know, I guess we should start right at the beginning here tell us how this concept for you came. Why ping pong?
All right. Well, I have a background in esoteric studies. I've published books, one of them co-authored with Jocelyn Godwin, who's a writer of Western esoteric, recognized as one of the greatest authorities, etc. So I have that kind of a background. At the same time, when I was much younger than I am now, I used to play ping pong, but never quite take it to the level I wanted to take it because there were other things to do, or I never found opponents that were particularly better than I was. So I dropped it, but it just stayed with me. It was like there waiting to bloom. And then we did a semi-epic road trip with our kids some years ago. They were teenagers already, and by the time we got to Big Sur in California, at the Henry Miller Memorial Library, we found there, on top of the beautiful redwoods and the beautiful memorabilia, table tennis. So we said, I asked my son if he wanted to play with me, and thinking that I would just demolish him because I used to think I was a good player, and we did play, and I lost very brutally from him. And the loss stayed with me, the defeat. And then I went back east in the Washington, D.C. area, and I began to look for a place in which to go and play some more ping pong. And I found a humble community center nearby, and I went there. And it happened to be peopled by predominantly Chinese players, and things changed. I mean, that was like stepping into another universe. Because I had never played that type of ping pong, which is table tennis at a very high level. I had no clue what they were doing. I could not read their spin. It was just almost embarrassing to be there. And, of course, at that moment, the choice would have been between, okay, I had enough of this, and I think I'll leave it to the pros, or I'll stick around and I'll make a fool of myself and I will be defeated 11-0 for the next 6 months, which is what happened, until I begin to make some sense of all these little balls, and that's what happened to me. Now, in the process, I found, and this is over not just over the next 6 months, but over the next 5 years, I found many parallels and analogies with concepts that I know from my studies, concepts that belong to the perennial philosophy or philosophia perennis, and they resonate with Taoism and Zen and Sufism and Plato and other such concepts that are, in my opinion, eternal. And it was very strange to find them mirrored in table tennis, but I did. And in the various chapters in the book, I explain what I came across. And it's usually half narrative because I do come across very peculiar characters and there are very many strange situations in which I find myself because of table tennis. And each chapter deals with some sort of philosophical aspect too. That's in a nutshell. That's what the book is about.
So is there a place where one can, from a metaphysical perspective, place themselves as the table, the ball, or the paddle?
No, I never quite saw it that way. The way it's funny, but the way it started was the idea of the non-linear thinking. We in the West, we do use a lot of linear thinking. We are conditioned from our upbringing, from what we learn at school, etc., from how the Western world works, to think of a cause and think of an effect. And that is technically called causality. And so we have very much a causal thinking. And then there is the nonlinear thinking, which is more of an accidental thinking, which is the one you find, for example, in the I Ching, etc., that has nothing to do with cause and effect. It's much more complex, or maybe much more natural. Now, I'll give you an example, and I'll give it to your listeners, too. For an example of nonlinear thinking, I will not give you a philosophical passage, but something that I saw on YouTube, which is a commercial for an instant scratch lottery from New Zealand. So, because this kind of thinking sometimes hides itself in the most unsuspected places. So I'll just quote from the book. It's a very short excerpt. Now, this is what the video shows. Students are taking an exam. A rather pompous professor is watching them while the clock is ticking. Time, thank you, he eventually says. Put down your pens and bring your papers to the front of the room. All students do so but one. He's wasting time scratching an instant lottery ticket, but he could be finishing the exam. This one student reaches the desk to turn in the exam past the allotted time. The professor says, I'm sorry, too late. The student is dumbfounded. I gave you plenty of warnings about time, resumes the professor. You failed. Sorry. Excuse me, says the student in a matter-of-fact tone. Do you know who I am? The professor contemptuously, I have absolutely no idea. Good, says the student, and places his paper in the middle of the stack. That's the idea. That's nonlinear thinking, okay?
I love that.
Now, yes, now it's not the student who's being examined, and it's not the student who failed. It's the professor who's being examined, and it's the professor who fails because he goes on with his assumptions. So this is the idea of the book, nonlinear thinking. And what happened to table tennis is that from a linear sport that it used to be, it became a nonlinear sport, thanks to the sandwich revolution. Now, table tennis, now if you go fairly close to where you are now, in to Big Sur, and you ask the very kind people at the Henry Miller Miller Memorial Library to give you equipment to play with, they will give you two hard bats. Now, hard bats are the type of bats that Henry Miller himself used to play with, and George Gershwin, and Arnold Schoenberg, and many other famous people who were attracted by table tennis. Hard bats essentially are wooden rackets, and then they have some rubber, which is with the pips out, those little pimples out, and that's it. So these hardbats produce very little spin. Essentially, it's a lot of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, with the ball traveling in very predictable ways. And what happens is that when he got at a high level, I'm speaking about world championships, etc., it was the rallies were incredibly boring because the players were very good, and it really was difficult to place a winner. It was back and forth, back and forth, and essentially one would win the point out of exhaustion. Now, what happened in the 50s is that a Japanese guy decided that he would put foam on his racket. What happened was that, and that was his secret weapon. Nobody had seen it until he unveiled his secret weapon at the, what was that, the Bombay World Championship in 1952. He unveiled his weapon, which was a normal racket with a lot of thick foam on both sides. Now, what would happen was that, first of all, there was no ping pong. There was ping and then silence because it didn't make any noise on the other side. So it was ping, boof, pong, boof, and that was disconcerting enough. But also, the little ball would penetrate into the foam and it would be catapulted back. So that was a lot faster. And also, the foam grabbed the ball, and if you did the exact movement, it would give it a lot of spin. Now, the ball was coming back to you much faster and with a lot of spin, and it was bouncing off the table in weird ways. It was bouncing up, or it was kicking down, or it was kicking to the side, depending on what the player would do. And, of course, he won the championship, and that was the beginning of the sandwich revolution. Now, what happened after that, the ITTF, which is International Tennis Table Federation, intervened and said, no, you cannot have a purely foam racket, and they made a compromise, and so they had the rubber and then the foam underneath and then the racket. That's why it's called the sandwich racket. Mm-hmm. And now players quickly realized that if you inverted the rubber and you no longer had the pips out, you had the pips in, plus the foam, that gave you still a lot of spin and still a lot of speed, as well as control. And those are the three factors, spin, speed, and control. And the game took off. It took off because it became essentially a game of spin. Now the parabolas were unpredictable. Now it was all about the top spin and the side spin and the back spin and the chopping and this and that. There is practically not a single ball without a lot of spin on it. And because the ball is so small and so light, you can impress a tremendous amount of spin on it, like 150 rotations per second. And when you receive a ball like that on the other side, unless you're able to read the spin and do what you need to do in order to counter it, the ball is going to go out or long or to the side or in the net. So it's very, very complex. And therefore, that's why I call it nonlinear. I'll tell you more. A friend of mine who's a very famous philosopher of science, his name is Rupert Sheldrake, lives in London, and every time I go to London, I play with him and his sons because I turn them on to table tennis, and it's kind of nice to see a philosopher with a table tennis in his basement, but that's exactly what he did. And he calls table tennis of this sort non-Euclidean because it's basically concerned with curved spaces and not the square spaces of Euclidean geometry. So, as you see, it's not something that I just wanted to call philosophy just because I liked it. Mm-hmm. It really presented a lot of analogies with a more complex world that we usually don't live in when we in our normal life. So I would go to a club once I became proficient, because until I wasn't proficient, it was just a matter of running around trying to catch balls desperately and falling many times on the floor. But once I became proficient, which is a hell of a lot of work and dedication, and a lot of being beaten, even by people, 20 years older, 30 years older, it's just that age doesn't matter so much because there's so much emphasis on technique. And if you don't have the correct technique, you can be as strong as Hercules, but you're still going to lose. So,
yeah. Well,
anyway, that's what I did.
Well, it's there's no question an enormous amount of research has gone into this and time and study and so forth, and just fascinating to me the depth of the history. And I've watched a number of different movies where they feature ping pong as the, or table tennis, however you want to refer to it, as the focal point of this particular drama or comedy or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, why in the world ping pong? Now, I used to play on a semi-regular basis with an older woman up here where we lived, and because she loved playing ping pong, mm-hmm. and they had a ping pong table set up in the garage. So I'd go over there, you know, once every few weeks, and we'd play several rounds. And I've never considered myself very good at it. I just, you know, because I don't play it that much. For me to get it across and have it come back and me hit it, that is an accomplishment, that I can return someone's serve or the volley, right? That, to me, is huge. the same thing as if I was playing tennis on a tennis court or something like that, because I don't have quite the eye-hand coordination that most people do. But for me, it wasn't about, even though we kept score, it wasn't about winning or losing from my perspective, at least at my level. It was really more about spending time with her and giving her the opportunity to get some exercise, to interact with other people and so forth. And that's kind of where I would come from as far as my experiences with ping pong.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, ping pong is the second participatory sport in the world.
Really?
After soccer. Yes, there are 400
that's
million
huge.
People. Who, yeah, 400 million people played. I don't even want to count China, because if I wanted to, then it would be a billion more. they teach it at school, you know, kids, everybody plays table tennis. I mean, I've been to China, there are concrete tables in the streets in Beijing, etc. It's everywhere. But the thing is, ping pong at its simplest level can be played by just about anyone, and it's entertaining. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. It's a pastime, and you can have a conversation, whatever, you know. Then there is the, how would you call it, competitive table tennis. And as I said, I mean, I could have left that community center saying, okay, now I've seen the real beast, and it can stay there. I don't need this. It's too much. Or you can push yourself and say, you know, why not? I mean, I'll go there after work, whatever, and see what happens. This was always usually in the evening, you know, when people get off work, etc. And it was just my luck that there were all these Chinese players there and others. It happens to be also a very international sport or cosmopolitan. I mean, I've met people from countries I didn't know existed. And I've interacted, therefore, and played with people from Madagascar to Mongolia to you name it. I mean, just about there's some island off the west coast of Africa that happens to be, I don't even remember the name of it, et cetera. Of course, all your East Asians, yes, because traditionally the sport is very well played there. But from Peru to Canada to Portugal, you name it, they're all there. And so even at that level, it's very interesting, and I think I reflect that in the Metaphysics of Ping Pong in my book, because it's an incredibly, it's highly social. It's very you go to these clubs and you become friends with these people because you keep going back to the same club and you become friends. And some are visiting, some are not. Some are regulars. Some come, some go, some don't stick around. You know, I mean, I've seen a lot of people. I call them the basement kings, who have a ping pong table in their basement, and they think they're good because they develop their homespun style, and then they challenge people like you or, you know, casual players.
Right.
And they beat them all the time. So it's, oh, I'm good. So they come to the club, and it's a spectacle. They don't know they're a spectacle, but they are, because they think they're good.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they're not very good because they don't know the fundamentals. You know, they don't know what the whole thing is about, and what they think was a terrific shot is not, because, you know, we trained, you know. I was never a basement king because I never had a basement with a table tennis, but I had played here and there, and I also thought I was pretty good. Well, no, I wasn't pretty good at all. And so playing was so It was kind of fun. If nothing else, it was fun to see the other players play because it was like being at the Olympics. I mean, I didn't believe that you could. It was like magic to see those balls, those trajectories, the speed, the spin, the reflex. I mean, it was incredible. And I stuck to it, and eventually I realized that it was very much like an initiation. No different from playing the violin or something. I mean, I'm at the beginning, and I'm picking on the violin because we had a son who did play the violin, and it was like you had to run out of the house, and you know, I mean, it was really cacophony. But at the beginning, it can be very discouraging, to the point that probably many people just give up because with a violin they cannot produce a decent sound.
Yeah,
see, the piano is better because the notes are already made for you. But the violin, you have to make them.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, and the ping pong, the same. I mean, what fun can it be if every ball that comes to you, you send it out or long or in the net or you just don't even get it. You know, just forget it. It's not for me. Well, anyway, I stuck it through, and I'm not the only one. There are lots of other people who went through exactly the same initiation.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, there are rites of passage. I mean, for example, the first time you were able to return a certain serve from a certain opponent. The first time you're able to win a point with a certain opponent. The first time, much later on, you actually win a whole match, etc. And then you go up and up and up in level, and then eventually I left that community center and I found a proper club, so to speak, with a ridiculously low fee. By the way, I want to say it's $60 a year, and you can play four times a week, and they supply the balls and the tables and the heating in the winter, and the cooling in the summer. It's ridiculous. If you break it down, it's cents a day. So another characteristic of table tennis is that it's cheap. It's a sport that I think can be, I mean, if you buy the most expensive racket imaginable, buying a certain rubber for the forehand and another one for the backhand, and you put it together with a certain blade, blah, 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 you're not going to spend more than $300, and that's a stretch. You can have a perfectly compatible racket, a near professional racket for 50. Mm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Now compare that to skiing or horseback riding or sailing or any of those sports.
Or even tennis for that matter, because tennis, those rackets
tennis
can go nuts.
It's very expensive. Yeah. So that's the thing. You're there, and everybody becomes really fanatical about their equipment. So you're there when you're waiting for your turn, talking to some other player, and what rubber do you have, and what are you using your backhand, and how's the, you know, and I have multiple things there. And in the end, they don't cost a lot of money. So you can have stuff that the professionals are using. Really, you can have their equipment very cheaply. You cannot do the same, for example, with skiing or any of that. I mean, there's no way that you can afford that kind of material and equipment. So that's another strange characteristic of table tennis that makes it so affordable.
Mm, interesting. We're talking with Guido Mina di Sospirio. He is the author of The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. We're going to continue our conversation. Fascinating. I'm finding it very interesting just in learning some of these different aspects that I did not know about this particular game. And we'll talk more about that as well as the specific metaphysical aspects of it. And we'll do that in just a moment here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Guido Mina di Sospirio, and he is the author of The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, and we're getting into some rather interesting depths as far as the more, we'll call them the more linear aspects of ping pong and then the history and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about the metaphysics, the metaphysical aspects of the game, as you have written about in your book, The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. And obviously, you know, this is just one of many different metaphors that we can use for life and living and coping and so forth. I'm curious, was there a Mr. Miyagi in your life as far as ping pong is concerned? Someone who trained you and coached you and led you along this path, or was this all self-taught?
No, there was. His name is Jaime Alvarez, and he used to be a professional table tennis player in his youth. at a time in which the Dominican Republic had produced a crop of world-class players for some reason. His brother was even better than he was ranked 12th in the world. You know, 12th in the world with all our Chinese. I mean, it's impressive. And I just met him casually at my club, and I quickly realized that he was in another category from anyone else I had met before. I mean, this man was just incredible, the things he could do. But he also has a calling for teaching. In his life, he's been a professor before becoming a banker and stuff. And so he does enjoy teaching because, you know, some of these people don't care to teach to newcomers like I was at the time. And I wasn't the best of students because I was rebellious, because I don't know why, frankly. Maybe because one thinks, it's just table tennis, I'll do whatever I want. But there are fundamentals there. There is a certain style to abide by if you want the best results, much as there is in skiing or whatever. And eventually I began to just go by what he was saying, which is very, very demanding. On one's body. I mean, he actually has a robo in his house with a table that throws balls at you, and you throw them back, and he collects them in a net, and he throws them back at you again. And you can put spin on the balls, you can put no spin on the balls, they can come to your left, to your right, you can mix it, and you can go on and on and on for hours, repeating the same movement. Which is a problem that we in the West probably have with repetition, because we find it boring. Now, when you think about the fact that in East Asia, the most important of all arts is still considered to this day calligraphy, and calligraphy is all about repetition, then you make the connection why they're so good at table tennis, because table tennis is a hell of a lot of repetition. I mean, there is one particular club in the D.C. area that I go to, another one, which is owned and operated by a Chinese father and son duo. And most of the players there are Chinese or Japanese or Korean. And sometimes they bring their child to take lessons. And the child, the five-year-old, the six-year-old, will be sending back the ball with a forehand time and time again, maybe, you know, 500 times over the hour, and that's it. That's what the lesson consists of. It seems very boring, but those repetitions must become second nature. And so when you need to do it, when you need to hit the ball, you don't have to think about anything. You know, the movement is perfect and it's there because you have solidified it. So we don't have that in the West anymore. We don't even learn cursive anymore. Nobody writes, and also art has become very anti-initiatory, in the sense that once, as you know, like the Renaissance, but even after that, you know, there would be a teacher who would apprentice his young boys to learn to paint, and they would come in there, and they'd be handyman. Basically, they would be doing everything, cleaning canvases, whatever, preparing the paints and mixing, etc., and then they would begin to do the hands or the background, and eventually they will graduate and become artists, and it will take time, years. And all of that is gone out the window also in the world of contemporary art, which has been for a long time abstract. Now it's coming back, the figurative art. But so people don't need to train. They just can put something on the canvas, and that's a painting, see? Mm. And the same, so it's a pervasive anti-initiatory attitude that we have in the West, in which the idea of being apprentice at something is considered quaint and old-fashioned, but nobody really seriously thinks of anything in those terms, whereas there's nothing like the relationship between a teacher and a student, or better yet, you know, the master and a disciple, you know,
yeah.
Because that's how you learn, and it's very painstaking, it's slow.
It's a real irony, if you will, that some of the movies that we enjoy in the West feature that very dynamic, that very paradigm. And yet, oh no, I'm going to do this on my own. There's that attitude.
There is a very strong do-it-yourself attitude, especially in America.
Yeah.
I write about it. I say that, you know, whilst we do have that, at the same time, we consign ourselves to perfect strangers when it comes to the most important things. For example, a perfect stranger puts you to sleep in a coma, the anesthesiologist, and another perfect stranger cuts you open, the mm-hmm. surgeon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but then we don't trust, we are distrustful of the teacher when it comes, at least I was,
yeah.
when it comes to learning table tennis. It's incredible. I mean, you just think, I don't need a teacher, you know, I'm self-taught. Well, yeah, you can be self-taught, and you can make a shortcut into a long cut. Because, I mean, if you can't afford it, it's different. But if somebody is offering his teachings to you and he's a worthy teacher, my goodness, it's a gift from the gods.
Yeah, I have to say that I've had some wonderful teachers in my life, in my chosen profession and vocation, and I'm very grateful to them. And
absolutely.
I try to pass that on when I can. I don't always get the opportunity, but I've always wanted. I always try to take the opportunity when I can to share what I do know, and that kind of stems from the perspective that, you know, self-taught is nice, but one of the things that I learned early on was that if I hoard or hang on to this information and I don't share it with anybody else out of fear being outdone, mm-hmm. I remember always being taught that, you know, there's always someone out there who's going to be worse than you, and there's always going to be somebody out there who's going to be better than you. Mm-hmm. Well, that may be true, but I took on the philosophy that if I don't pass this information on to someone else who can do the same kinds of things, I can never move on to other things that I'd like to be pursuing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm going to get stuck. And I think that that's what has happened in this country over the last 150 years with people whose families have been in various industrial areas, like, say, the auto industry or mining. Well, my grandfather and my father, and so I've got to do this because that's what we do, and that's just what this family is about. And it's like, well, but is that really what you want to do? And so then you've got to put yourself out there to find the teacher to teach you those things. I'm in favor of someone pursuing or following their intuition. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yes, I agree. And by the way, it all has to do with the whole idea of initiation. In order to be initiated, you need a teacher.
Yeah.
You can't. But that, too, is perceived as elitist. It's not. It's just learning. I mean, I've found something else. I mean, again, with table tennis as a metaphor of life. Some people, now, as I was telling you, spin is central to the game of table tennis.
Yes.
It really is central.
Uh-huh.
But it's difficult. It's difficult to learn it, and it's difficult to counter it. So some people take the shortcut, which is they buy anti-spin rubbers. Now, these rubbers don't produce any spin, but at the same time, they don't feel any incoming spin. So you don't have to be worried about what is there on the ball. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Or there are other rubbers which have long pips, and these do the strangest thing. They actually reverse the spin that's coming and neutralize it. So these are kind of, I call it trickery, and I think these rubbers should be outlawed. They should be banned because they deny the essence of the game, which is spin. Now, these people I call empiricists because they deny the mystery, which is at the core of table tennis. And they think they're taking a shortcut. They say, you know what, I can't be bothered with that. I'm not going to learn it. I'm just going to buy this. I don't need to bother. Well, their shortcut becomes a long cut because I've seen people who, 10 years on, they're still playing with those tricky rubbers because they never graduate to the real game. And those rubbers will allow a player to win up to 16 or 1700 ranking. But once they meet an opponent who is higher than their ranking, there's nothing they can do. And so it's all useless. So the shortcut becomes the long cut.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's essentially a treatise on laziness and on fear and on people who don't want to live up to their own potential, although they could, just because they don't want to make the effort. And the thing is, it's funny to find such radical statements about one's state in life from something that will be perceived as a silly pastime like ping pong. But once it's played at a competitive level and you begin to be serious about it, well, then as every other discipline, as every other sport, or, you know, it needs application, it needs a lot of work.
Yeah. I remember learning about metaphysics as far as my understanding, not only of the concept, the philosophy, if you will, the principles, But more importantly, from my perspective, was the actual definition of the word. Mm-hmm. And when I actually looked up the definition of the word, and it's very simple, metaphysics is beyond the physical. And it was during a conversation with somebody about, you know, various religions, you know, and I said, well, you're all bent out of shape about metaphysics, but what you don't understand is your religion, and their particular belief system was Christianity. Mm-hmm. Your religion is a metaphysical system because it's about that which is beyond the physical. That's what it teaches. And they didn't care much for that, but that was the reality of it. So when we're talking about the metaphysics of ping pong, we're talking about that which is beyond the physical aspects of the game itself. And certainly taking into account the descriptions that you have given of the various physical parameters and the gamesmanship and of course, the shortcuts versus the long cuts. When you start putting those into the metaphysical perspective, as we would want to do, to take a look at our lives, to take a look at where we're going and what we're doing and why we're doing it, I think that one of the aspects of East versus West, if you will, just as the using that as a broad metaphor. I found it interesting conversing with people, and of course you're not exactly from the West as far as Italy. It's not, you know, it's not considered the East, but it certainly has a different philosophical point of view or perspective. It seems to me that the founders or the foundations, let me put it that way, of this country, of the United States, as far as its breakaway from Britain and the whole process that it underwent, to foster individuality, it seems that I've heard it put this way, that we had to go through that process of promoting individuality and doing it yourself kind of thing in order to get to the place where we begin to understand that actually what's more important is community. Is connection. And so it's interesting looking back at history and the processes that we as human beings have been through and where we are today, because the aspect of community, of connectedness, of being all being part of the same, of being part of the whole, is really beginning to be understood more and more. But here in the West, we're still very, very resistant to that message.
Well, there's a lot on the plate here. Let's start in order. You mentioned metaphysics at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the etymology of the word goes back to Andronicus of Rhodes, who was a philosopher who put Aristotle's works in order. And Aristotle had written the physics, and then every writing of his that came after the physics, he called it metaphysics, which means not beyond, but after or in addition to.
Okay.
So now metaphysics traditionally is a branch of philosophy whose objective is to understand the nature of first principle, visible or invisible, and concerns itself with being as being and the first causes of things. So a traditional metaphysician is one who tries to discover what underlies everything. That's what metaphysics are. That's the technical definition from philosophy. Now, the popular meaning is the one you were speaking about.
Beyond
physics. Mm-hmm. That's not what I refer to in this book.
Okay.
This is really about discovering the origin of everything. And to do so, in this book specifically, in the chapter about metaphysicians and empiricists, I resort to Plato's famous allegory of the cave, which I will quickly mention for those who may not be familiar with it. Now, there's a cave in which these people dwell, and it's a very large and cave deep in the mountains, and there's some shadow play being projected on the wall. And the people seeing it inside the cave think that that's reality. Now, one of these people one day finds a stairway and that leads him outside. And the outside, he sees a world that is much more vibrant, in which everything is truer, and in which he sees not an illusion, but the reality. And that world is the world of forms, or the world of archetypes. It's actually the world of ideas, idea in Greek, but idea no longer means what it meant in ancient Greek. So let's call it the world of archetypes, the world of forms.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back into the cave, elated, and tells his people, listen, I found the true world. I found the world of forms. This is an illusion. Come with me and I'll show it to you. And instead of thanking him, they resent him. They talk back to him and they want to beat him up and lynch him, even. Because who are you to tell us that this is not true? And basically the shadow play on the wall, it could be like somebody telling you, let's go to the movies and that's the real world, what you see on the screen. Understand? So it's just, okay. So the reality of the allegory of the cave that Plato wrote many years ago, and of course about which Aristotle had a lot to say, a lot of negative things to say, hence the rift that we find in contemporary societies too, between Plato and Aristotle, etc., is that we essentially hang on to forms that are not corresponding to reality. What we know is not what is true. And in table tennis, there is form. And we've also been conditioned to think that form is a formality, that form is not essential, that the essence is not the form. But in fact, I have discovered, empirically, if you will, that in table tennis, form is everything. Form is not of the essence. Form is the essence. And so whenever a player of our level gets closer to perfect form, he enters that world of forms about which Plato wrote so memorably. And for example, I'll give you an example. Sometimes I've seen this happen. There are two players which are good players, competitive players, but they're not champions, of course. They're just, you know, they're not professionals. And they will exchange a rally of a level which normally does not belong to either one of them. I mean, really, really superior rally, something that you could see at a championship. When they're done with the rally, they both stop and they say, did you see that? Did that come from us? You know, because they themselves are surprised that they would have produced something so refined. Well, they had a glimpse of the world of forms.
Mm.
So, yes. So, it really is a metaphysical exploration, because you will find, for example, my teacher, Jaime Alvarez, his ranking is very high, even at his age. I mean, it's about 2,300. Now, the world champion is 2,600. So, you understand, he's very high. He doesn't play to win, although he will win all the time. He plays, in other words, sometimes I see that he has different options for a certain shot, mm-hmm. and instead of taking the easiest one, he takes always the most demanding one. Because it's not about winning, it's about doing your very best and always trying to strive towards the world of forms. Now, these are the ones I call metaphysicians in table tennis. And then there are the empiricists, who are the ones who will buy those tricky rubbers I was mentioning before, mm-hmm. and refuse altogether to explore the mystery at the core of table tennis, which is spin, which is a very, very strange phenomenon that allows a player to defy physics almost. And they just refuse to do that because they hang on to the reality they perceive as the reality, which is illusory. And they try to turn table tennis into a flat game of no spin balls, but it is not. So they are denying the very essence of the game. And I find that, by extension, there are people like that in life, apart from table tennis. You know? And especially when, if you decide that you want to play table tennis as your hobby, and your hobby becomes your passion, and you're dedicated to it, and you spend time, and you sweat, and you ache, and this and that, why not do it in the best possible way? Why settle for slithering when you can fly?
Right. So, if I'm understanding correctly, your teacher is
wanting to continue to, this was what came to mind, challenge himself.
Exactly.
Rather than taking the easy way, hey, I could win with this shot if I hit it this way, which
exactly.
would be fine. Well, what's the point of that? The whole point is to play the game. And I've even
yes.
heard it said that some people, I don't know if this is true in ping pong, but maybe this is where your teacher comes from. I've heard in some other types of games that people, in an effort to frustrate the other player, in a manner of speaking, mm-hmm. they will play in an attempt to play to a draw. In other words, they're not trying to win, but they're not going to allow the other person to win.
Mm-hmm.
So they will, again, still as part of the process of challenging themselves, they want to play to a draw kind of thing. So in other words, the volley
yeah.
continues back and forth.
That is not the case.
Not the case. Okay.
No. No, because he wouldn't be playing at the very best possible way. I mean, it's all about, and also you were speaking also in your long premise about the differences between the East and the West. I found a marked difference, again, when it comes to causality versus accidentality. I've noticed this time and again, and I eventually understood it. With Chinese players, I would execute a technically demanding shot, and it would work. It would land on the table and maybe even win me the point. And I would say, that's a great shot, or somebody in the room would say, that's a great shot. And they would say, no, that's a lucky shot. And I would get a little upset, saying, what do you mean unlucky shot? I wanted to do that shot, and I did it, so it's not a lucky shot. It's a deliberate shot that I did because I wanted to. And they say, yes, but it's a high probability, it's a low probability shot. Therefore, the fact that it hit the table and you made the point means that luck was involved with it.
Hmm.
And that's how they see life. It's accidental. And us, it's like, no, cause and effect. If I decide to do this, that's the cause, and I do it that way, then the effect will be that, you know, and it's a completely, completely different mentality. I mean, their mindset is another world. And their, you know, the I Ching, their great book, one of the greatest books of mankind, which is considered by many an oracular book, but it's a lot more than that, is mainly concerned with accidentality, with things that interact with one another by accident, rather than I'm going to turn on the faucet so water will come out, which is, you know, how we think.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you go play table tennis at a high level and you meet all these East Asians, and not just East Asians, also Thailandese, Vietnamese, etc., you come across a difference in mindset, which is not a cliche. It's really palpable. It's palpable. And it's interesting. It makes it yet more interesting because you begin to think, wait a minute, you challenge your own assumptions. You challenge your own beliefs. You say, well, maybe they have a point. Maybe it was a lucky shot after all.
Mm-hmm.
We in the West think of a lucky shot when you hit the net by chance and the ball still goes on the other side. We call that lucky shot. Well, no kidding. Or when it hits the edge. You know, of course it's a lucky shot. But for them to say that a beautiful shot that you really were trying to pull off and you did pull off is a lucky shot, to us sounds like an insult. But if you think about it, they have a point. It's a low probability shot that went in because luck intervened. Otherwise, it would always go in, and they don't.
Well, I'm just curious from your perspective. I think I know what your answer is going to be, but from your perspective, is accidental wrong and causal correct? Are they both right? Are they both wrong? I mean, where do you stand on that thing? Or is it just a matter of perspective?
Well, causal is just like for, it's very elementary in my opinion, and you cannot presume to build true metaphysics on something so elemental. As I said before, if I turn on the faucet, the water will come out of the pipe. If the piping is, you know, if everything is in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, you can't imagine to disembowel the mysteries of the universe with that kind of a way of thinking. I mean, come on, we've had in the scholastic philosophy of the Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas, who went about proving the very famous four proofs of the existence of God. He proved the existence of God with four proofs, which were all logical. And I mean, come on. I mean, but that stayed around for centuries. You don't prove it that way. I mean, there's much more mysterious things that happen, so to speak, accidentally, quote unquote, that are precisely for their nature that seem so not connected. You know, we've all heard about, you know, the butterfly flapping the wings on one side of the world and the hurricane happening, you know, 6,000 miles away. You know, that kind of thing, the theory of chaos, which is another thing I speak about in the book. So, no, I tend to have an accidental outlook on life, because that's what not only my studies have taught me, but in my experiences also. So,
well, okay, I'm going to throw something at you then, because I would really like your perspective on this. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a clear explanation for you as to why. All I know is that somewhere deep down inside of me, I know that my existence and the existence of the universe as it is today, as it is right now, was not an accident, that my life has meaning. And if I didn't have that within myself, then it wouldn't matter what I did in my life. I could rape, plunder, and pillage to my heart's content for as long as I live, because life has no meaning. But as I said, there's something inside of me that says my life does have meaning. Ergo, there's a reason for the existence of the universe and my part in it. Ergo, there must have been a cause, because here I am at the moment, this moment of effect, if you will.
Okay. All right. Now, here's the thing. Another factor that influences us in our lives is the application of statistics. We hear statistics from all sides. When you insure your car, when you insure your house, when you go to the doctor, whatever, there's always statistics at play. But in fact, what really matters in life is the anti-statistical, which in antiquated language would have been called the miraculous. I'll explain myself. There are about 110 million sperm cells in an average ejaculation. Out of that 110 million, only one sperm will manage to fertilize the egg, and there will be a new conception, a new life, you, me. So unless it was artificial insemination, we've all gone through that. So we are the result of a lottery, because the stakes against us were inconceivable, 1 to 110 million, and yet we were conceived. Okay, that is the anti-statistical occurrence, which is at the very root of our life. Without that, winning the lottery, we wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be speaking to me. I wouldn't be speaking to you.
Okay.
So it's magical. I mean, it's miraculous. I mean, we are, but we take it for granted because we're here. Mm. We just take it for granted, but
okay.
We shouldn't.
I see what you
see?
Mean. Yeah.
Yeah, we just take it for granted, because there's so many people in the world, but all of us, and I repeat, except the ones, but it's a tiny minority who were artificially inseminated, all of us are the result of a very strange concatenation of events that led the one sperm, which was a better swimmer than the others or whatever it was, to get to that one egg and fertilize it. It's really, really difficult.
And I take it to the macro level to kind of accentuate your position that there are things hurtling through the universe all the time. We might actually get a glimpse of something like the collision of two bodies out in the universe somewhere through our telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are things that are hurtling all over the place, even around this planet and by this planet, and we don't seem to get hit by anything that is really that large. And, of course, now I'm speaking with the modern era of man, is in terms of man's existence from his beginning, wherever and however that happened, because certainly there's evidence to show that this planet was hit by something and it destroyed, you know, say all the dinosaurs. That's at least one of the theories.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting here thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, everybody's all concerned about, you know, a meteor. I remember it was not that long ago. I mean, just about a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly there was this meteor that was headed towards Earth. And it wasn't going to pass by. It was going to hit us. Well, it didn't. But the odds may be astronomical, so that if something does hit this little spot out here in the middle of the universe, that is probably, and I'm going to put it in the category, that is probably as miraculous as your example of that one sperm cell out of the millions finding the egg, getting in, and beginning a whole new life.
Well, I mean, the whole everything is conceived for redundancy. I mean, there are 110 million sperms in an average ejaculation of a young male because of the fact that it's not easy to fertilize an egg. By the same token, if you have a mature oak tree, there are tens of thousands of acorns on
yes.
it, all of them falling down, and how many oaks are you going to get out of that? You know, not many, because there are birds, because there is this, because there is that. So there's a built-in redundancy for us and animals and plants to continue to carry on.
Well, there's another type of tree also out here in the West that it can't continue on unless there's a fire. And
yeah,
the fire sequoia. Heats up the seed that pops open, and mm-hmm. so if there's no fire, there's not that heat. Those seeds just sit there, and they decay, and they turn back into the dirt that fertilizes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I certainly can understand the philosophical position and point that you make. I think it's a valid one, and I think that if we started to look especially at your example and not take our existence from that perspective for granted, then maybe we might begin the process of treating one another, the other members of our community, maybe with a little bit more respect, if not reverence, and understanding, you know?
Oh, yes.
Did you know that you're lucky to be here?
Well, yeah, that's the idea. And there's also another thing we were speaking about initiation before, which is such a central
yes.
concept in the metaphysio ping pong. And the most unrenounceable initiation, now to initiate means to begin, right? So the most unrenounceable initiation that we all go through is from being a fetus to becoming a baby. We pass through that complicated thing, which is called delivery. We are delivered, and we are a new entity. I mean, we're completely different from what we used to be just hours before when we're born. And that's our first initiation, without which we will not be alive. Now, yes, there are cesarean deliveries, etc., but again, sure. the vast majority, billions of human beings have born, were born, will continue to be born that way. And
yeah.
that is unrenounceable because we really change state. An initiation means that you go from one state of existence to another. And that happens, it's at the very core of our coming to this world, from the mother's womb into this world. And before that, at the beginning of the other initiation is the conception, which is a highly anti-statistical occurrence, which would have been called a miracle once.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that, it seems to me, were based into this kind of esoteric discourse of first the anti-statistical occurrence and then the initiation. But all of that doesn't seem, well, it's not taught at school. Nobody tells us these beautiful things. I mean, it would be nice if kids, you cannot do this to a six-year-old, but, for example, at the beginning of middle school,
mm-hmm.
at the time in which they already know how a child is born, etc., they've been taught, if they were told these things, perhaps it will contribute to sanctify life a little more, as opposed to just, you know, we're a bunch of molecules and this and that and the nervous system and whatever, you know, which is true. I mean, it's the way the engine works, but we are not engines. We're a lot more than that.
Yes, yes. Very interesting. I am fascinated by this. You know, the other aspect I wanted to ask you as far as in the initiation, when you speak of initiation in this context, are you speaking primarily of the natural occurring initiation, or is it something? Let me see if I can clarify. There are things specifically within science, okay, that we have discovered that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is always to these kinds of things. Just because we can, does it mean that we should?
And well, no, obviously not, because then otherwise we'll be dropping atomic bombs all over again. I mean, it's
not just that, but also in terms of medicine and in terms of creating new individuals through other than artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization and so forth. I'm talking going beyond that to say cloning. It's like, aren't there enough people that we don't really need to be cloning one another and making duplicates and that kind of thing, among other things?
That's a very highly philosophical question because I remember reading about these people whose dog had died, and they really liked that dog, so they wanted to clone it.
I've read that article.
To have it all over again. It was millions of dollars to do it. I don't know if it worked.
Well, and I don't know that I'd want to do that myself. As much as I love my dogs, it's they've lived, and I want to let them rest in peace. And besides, there's no guarantee that the clone is going to be of the temperament
of
and personality, because it is a copy. It is technically a copy, not a duplicate.
Yeah.
Like zeros and ones in computers.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And I know that's highly philosophical, but I always find it interesting, especially when, you know, I start seeing some of these news reports about these various bugs that are out there, viruses and so forth, and that the antidotes that we have created, or the cures or what have you, the vaccines are no longer effective because the virus has mutated and mutated and mutated. And
yeah, it's
a super
how we say mutated for the virus, but we say evolved for animals.
It's very good.
they evolved too. It's not just limited to us, you know, and animals and plants. I mean, of course.
Well, I mean,
also there's a matter of abusing, for example, antibiotics. You know, that if you take them all the time for anything, then they're not going to be effective anymore. Well, duh. they should be taken sparingly, you know, once in a while, and they will still be effective. But anyway, going back to table tennis, you will find in this book, I think, many of these questions. There are, for example, going through the index here. The century, initiation, war tactics, etc. And then the humbleness of giants, which is about some of these exceptional people I met, and translation, prophecies, the importance of the teacher, who wins the race. I mean, it's just metaphysics and experiences, the dark side, the secret workings of the shadow, which I thought was something that happened to me, in which I realized that sometimes it is not you making the decision, it's your shadow making it for you, and it's something to be aware of.
Yeah.
And then the theory of chaos, and Homo Ludens is a chapter all about our need to play, even as adults, which has been thwarted. I mean, I think that playing is as frowned upon as sex was during the Victorian age. I mean, how many times have you heard grow up?
Yes.
When somebody, maybe in his 30s, is exhibiting characteristics that we would associate more with a child, but I don't mean in a bad way. I mean that he wants to play or she wants to play. Well, play is frowned upon. It's a huge industry. I mean, if you think of video games and stuff like that, it's just a huge industry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's frowned upon because you're supposed to be serious. You're supposed to let go of the playing. I mean, now I think that the sex is overrated. I mean, there's just too much of it now. It's just to the point of nausea because, we've been liberated. We've been over-liberated enough already, whereas play is a taboo.
Yeah.
You cannot really, I mean, once you get past your puberty, you shouldn't really be so involved with playing anymore. And I find that, you know, people like to play at old ages. All ages. I mean, whatever it is, cards or ping pong or whatever. And it's frowned upon. So there's a Dutch philosopher who wrote a beautiful book about it called Homo Ludens, Playing Man. And I find that in my experience with the metaphysics of ping pong, I found a lot of highly successful professionals who would come to the club or to various other clubs and spend their free time playing and sweating and aching and cursing and after a little celluloid ball. And you think, my goodness, I mean, is table tennis so relevant to them? Not table tennis in itself, probably, but playing. Because the thing about playing, unless you're playing for money, is ending itself. The reward is the playing and the winning. But you don't win anything. You don't win a house. You don't win a car. You don't win anything. You just play for the sake of playing.
Yes.
And again, that seems not causal because, well, what are you playing for? Who cares? But people, I found dedication that I never expected to find. I mean, people who just will play every point as if their life depended on it. Not in a nasty way. They just give it their all.
Exactly.
And I love that. I do love that. I think that if you're doing it as your hobby, as your passion, why not give it your all? That's why I don't understand about people who go there and engage in trickery and buy those anti-spin things, etc. Why?
Yeah,
I mean, why don't you want to learn it at its very best, again, to approach that world of forms that Plato wrote about 2,700 years ago?
Yeah. I remember back in Phoenix, where I used to live, my first wife and I bought a home, and we had kids in the neighborhood. They were, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then their teens, early teens, high school kids. And we had a double-wide driveway, and there was a pole there that used to have a basketball backboard and so forth. And I decided that I was going to get a backboard, and I was going to put it up there. And when I got everything all set up and it was all done, I invited them over and, hey, come on over and play, but I want you to understand that there is one rule, that there are no rules, meaning that this is not about competition. Mm-hmm. We're here to enjoy ourselves. We'll play a game, but it's not to the death here, okay?
Okay.
So no NBA checking and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, after about, I guess, 2 or 3 months, and we were really enjoying it, somebody came out one late night and hung on the rim and broke the rim off of the backboard, and I just was so dejected, I didn't even bother repairing it. I just took it all down. Because I thought, if that's the kind of respect that I'm getting for providing an opportunity to enjoy oneself, then what's the, it was disappointing and so forth. But the point that I'm getting to is that it was there to play. And you could play with your, not as if your life depended on it, but, give it your all. If you're going to make that shot, take it, and so on and so forth. And I've believed that even in my career. I've never been concerned with what competition is doing. I'll let the general managers and the sales managers and the program directors do that. I'm concerned about making our workplace, our radio station, better today than it was yesterday, and tomorrow make it better than it is today. And that's the competition that I'm about. So when you talk about these people who are there and they will play a shot, in a manner of speaking, as if their life depended upon it, but not in that aggressive way, but just giving it their all, it's like, gee, what if we would take on the mentality, the attitude that, guess what? Today is the last day of your life. How are you going to live it?
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So on this note...
Yes, I wanted to, first of all, thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us here on the program. I encourage you, if you find yourself out of here in Santa Barbara, I would love to have you live in studio to continue this conversation.
Well, you know how much I love Santa Barbara, so...
Yes, absolutely.
Consider it an open invitation. All right, thank you so much.
There you go. Number two, give us the website where people can get more information, they can order the book, they can find out more about you, the philosophy, and so forth, and maybe even touch base with you.
Yes. Okay, the website is my name, which is Guido Mina di Sospiro, and it's spelled Guido, and then it's -mina-di-sospiro.com, and they'll find all the information they need in there, my including my emails if they want to send something.
All right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they can just Google Guido Mina di Sospiro and The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, title of the book. We will be linked to your website, so that'll also be a much simpler way of getting to you as well. But go to our website, richarddugan.com, and click on Guido's link there on the archives page.
Yeah, just one word of caution.
Yes.
I think that if you go and you put The Metaphysics of Ping Pong or my name on Google, the edition that comes out is the UK edition, which came out earlier. This, what we're talking about, is the U.S. edition. They're identical in content, but the U.S. edition is less expensive.
Right.
So buy that one.
Right.
We'll make sure to link to the U.S.
It's
Quest Books, and it's from the U.S. Because otherwise, the other one, it comes from England, and it's import, whatever. It's more expensive. So.
And before we let you go, I have three questions that I ask my guests as we wrap up our program. Number one, who is Guido Mina di Sospiro?
The one we've been speaking about for an hour and a half.
Very good.
Okay.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Oh, I like to touch people's lives. I'll give you a very fast example. Another book I wrote called The Story of You, which is a story of a yew tree, written by the yew tree itself, so to speak. Then one day I received an email from a student, a university student, a girl from Missouri, I think. And she, to make a long story short, she said that her best friend had committed suicide and she was feeling depressed and down and she was contemplating the same idea. And then she read this book of mine and it changed her life and she was happy and that was not going to happen anymore. And I think that that one email that I got out of all the fan mail that I got in my life kind of gave me the feeling that I've done one thing right in my life. So that's what I want to do. I want to touch people and give them something that may be very much close to their lives, like a tree or like a ping pong table, but they don't realize how much there is there. And I'm just there to open the road for them, open the door.
And of course, with these questions, you may have answered them in a more elongated way. So this allows you to codify it down if you'd like. Final question is, what is your life's purpose?
Well, that's it. I think it's just what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I have access to a lot of stuff, and I have a certain facility with writing, etc. And I like to point things out to people who may be unaware of them and share the fruits of my research in an entertaining way and lead them on to something and then for them to take it up and do their own explorations.
Well, I thank you for doing that here on this program today and look forward to talking with you again about the work that you're doing and the people that you're touching and the insights that you have and will continue to receive over the years to come.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. That is Guido Mino di Sospiria. And the book entitled The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.